Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, The Boomerang Home. We'll take calls later from young adults who have moved back in with your parents and from you parents of those young adults. Does it sound something like this?
Haley has no plan for her future whatsoever. She's living in our basement, taking community college classes in, well, meandering.
So we're going to take her out. We'll have some fun.
And then gently ease her into a friendly conversation about her future.
Is that what you and your modern family sounds like? We'll talk about it and take your calls. Also, with all equine facing eyes on Belmont Raceway this week with a possible triple crown for California Chrome, we will look at the history of horse racing culture in New York City. But first, we talked yesterday about former Brooklyn DA Charles Hines under investigation for spending on his reelection campaign last year, allegedly using public funds. But what kind of public funds? Well, it was money that was seized from drug dealers and other criminals or accused criminals. So we will take a closer look now at where some of that money comes from, specifically at the practice known as forfeiture, which turns out to be very controversial. Our guest, Isaiah Thompson, did an investigation into forfeiture for the news organization ProPublica, and he joins us now. Hi, Isaiah. Thanks for coming on today.
Hi, Brian. I'm a longtime listener. It's a pleasure to be on.
Great to have you. To explain what forfeiture is, or to begin, I want to play an excerpt of an interview that you did with a woman named Sandra Leno describing her family's forfeiture story. Can you set this up for us?
Yeah. I met Sandra Leno outside of a courtroom in Philadelphia where I was doing this investigative series into civil forfeiture in the city of Philadelphia. She was one of dozens of people who show up at this courtroom every day who are attempting in one way or another to retrieve property that was seized from them by police initially and then seized from them legally by the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office via civil forfeiture. Ms. Leno had lost her house after her husband was arrested on drug charges. She had been accused of no crime. She had three children. And shortly after her husband was arrested and, you know, had not been convicted and was still living in the house with them, the entire family was forced to leave their house because the house was declared, what's the phrase they use? It was connected to the crime in theory. And so because the drugs had been allegedly dealt from the house. And so the district attorney's office had moved to seize the entire house.
So here is Sandra Leno from the interview that you did. This begins with her referring to her husband, referring to her husband who had not been convicted when their house was seized.
Now, this case was still open. They took my house. Well, they took it under a forfeiture. Then they came in on July 16th with trash trucks. Now, we were still not in the house and took all my possessions from the second floor and threw them in the garbage. I was allowed to take one vehicle and I was given 20 minutes to take what I could, but I was not allowed to take anything of value. My husband tried to take his coin collection. They wouldn't let him take it. Anything that we could possibly sell to make money, they would not let us take. We had to find a place to live. We spent 3 days in a tent, sleeping in a tent, me and my three children and my husband.
Sandra Leno is interviewed by our guest, Isaiah Thompson, who wrote about forfeiture laws for ProPublica. And that sounds like a horrible story. What's the bigger context that it fits into?
Yeah, it's quite a story, and I should probably just point out her husband was eventually convicted, but the it's also worth mentioning that the police officers who initially arrested him are now under investigation and are not allowed to testify in court in Philadelphia because of allegations of drug dealing within the Philadelphia police force. So, you know, there's an interesting context to that story. But in fact, I met lots of people. There are a lot of people who have lost their houses to civil forfeiture in Philadelphia who are a lot of them are single mothers or single grandmothers who've had maybe a grandson or a son accused, sometimes convicted, not necessarily convicted, of a crime, often a single instance of dealing drugs out of a house that they owned, who have lost their houses.
And so those are some Philadelphia examples from your story. Here's another story that's New York-based. This ran in Gothamist here in New York in January of this year. Reading from the beginning of the article here, it says, in the middle of the night in March of 2012, NYPD officers burst into the Bronx home of Gerald Bryan, ransacking his belongings, tearing out light fixtures, punching through walls, and confiscating $4,800 in cash. Bryan, 42, was taken into custody on suspected felony drug distribution as the police continued their warrantless search. Over a year later, Bryan's case was dropped. When he went to retrieve his $4,800, he was told it was too late. The money had been deposited into the NYPD's pension fund. Bryan found himself trapped in the NYPD's labyrinthine civil forfeiture procedure, a policy based on a 133-year-old law which robs poor New Yorkers of millions of dollars every year, a law that has been ruled unconstitutional twice. So that's a heck of a story. And I wonder if you can elaborate on the 133-year-old portion of that. Did you look into, for your reporting, where forfeiture laws come from?
Yeah, sure. Forfeiture laws are as old as the Republic. And, they're based on the premise that the government has the ability to seize property that is connected to crime. It's essentially the government suing the property itself. And there is some reason for this. There is some justification for this. Something that we can probably all imagine is, a drug dealer's yacht being seized by the government or something like that.
Clearly ill-gotten gains.
That's right, yeah. In older times, these laws were applied to smuggler cargo and pirate ships and that sort of thing. But what's happened is that as part of the so-called war on drugs, forfeiture was greatly expanded in the United States starting in the 80s and 90s and has really ballooned, even as we're having this kind of public discussion about whether the war on drugs has worked. Forfeiture has just continued to grow almost exponentially. And what you have is government on every level, the federal government, county government, state government, every kind of law enforcement agency you can imagine is increasingly engaging in seizing assets and then keeping them. And because these laws are civil, they're not criminal, the owners of these properties do not have the same kind of rights by a long shot that they would have in a criminal situation. They don't have a right to an attorney. They don't have the advantage of the government's having to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt as you would in a criminal case. And so it's become incredibly easy for government on every level to seize property and keep it and make it extremely difficult for the owners of that property to get their property back.
So one of the big distinctions that you make is between civil forfeiture and criminal forfeiture. Criminal forfeiture would be once you're already convicted of a crime, if they decide through that due process that there's reason to take away your money or possessions to some degree because it was ill-gotten gains, either to reimburse victims or to reimburse the state for their prosecution costs against you. But civil prosecution or civil forfeiture, I should say, as you're pointing out, is taking your stuff before you're convicted of anything.
Usually, yeah, that's exactly right. As part of my investigation in Philadelphia, one of the things that I learned was I was able to compare what was going on here, where I live, to Pittsburgh, another city in Pennsylvania operating under the same state laws, where after a judge's ruling some time ago, in Pittsburgh, the district attorney's office only pursues forfeiture after a prosecution. So you might call that criminal forfeiture. After a conviction. You might call that criminal rather than civil forfeiture. And one of the differences is that in Philadelphia, we have thousands and thousands of forfeiture cases, civil forfeiture cases, every year. In Pittsburgh, there are a handful.
Huh. So this is So it varies city by city or locality by locality, depending on how aggressive the prosecutors and the police want to be about it. Are you familiar with New York?
Not really. You know, I did a little bit of looking into New York when I was working on the story, but that's exactly right. I mean, one of the interesting things about forfeiture is that it's happening differently everywhere. So you had a case in widely publicized in Tenaha, Texas, where sheriffs were stopping drivers and essentially demanding that they hand over cash on the spot or face arrest, and then sort of subjecting it to forfeiture via paperwork later. The ACLU pursued that case and won a settlement in which the sheriff's office agreed to stop doing that. And that's a very different situation than, for example, in Philadelphia, where police essentially seize everything, you know, any amount of cash they can find in not necessarily an arrest, but maybe a traffic stop, or any other kind of stop. And then the DA pursues that money via a lawsuit. It's usually small enough amounts that the owners of the money don't pursue it, but rarely is it tied to any kind of criminal conviction. I don't know how forfeiture is happening in New York. I looked for statistics when I was writing that article, and I looked for more last night, and there's not a lot of information.
Well, the Gothamist article from January says the practice became more prevalent in the 1980s when jurisdictions around the country began pursuing cases involving money in both civil and criminal court. In an effort to fight organized crime and deprive criminals of their income, even if they couldn't imprison them. And it says last summer, The New Yorker, maybe you read that article, published a sprawling investigation on how cities use the practice to bolster their cash-strapped coffers by seizing the assets of the poor, often on trumped-up charges. With respect to New York City, it says the civil forfeiture process has long been used by the NYPD to seize money from those least likely to get it back. And it says any arrest in New York City can trigger a civil forfeiture case if money or property is found on or near a defendant, regardless of the reasons surrounding the arrest or its final disposition. So one of the things I was wondering is if Hines spent $200,000 of forfeiture money on his reelection campaign as DA, as alleged, how big a pot might he have been dipping into? How much of that money would the Brooklyn DA's office be holding?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, one of the things that I think is one of the most important issues around forfeiture, and one of the least sort of understood and explored, is, you know, most state laws allow the law enforcement agencies engaging in forfeiture to keep the proceeds. And that's really a major change in how government works. Usually we have elected representatives appropriate money. That might be city council, you know, it might be your state, if it's the state police, whatever body, and, you know, give that money to an agency, and that is the power of oversight, is the power of the purse. But forfeiture is changing that when it comes to law enforcement, because it's allowing law enforcement agencies to raise their own money and keep their own sort of separate funds from this activity. And it's tying the activity to funds in a way that is really unique and is really different than how government normally operates. So one of the results is that you have big pots of money all over the place that often are being misspent. So in, I don't want to mess this up, but in Fulton County, Georgia, the district attorney was found to have spent forfeiture money on, let's see, it was basketball tickets and some fancy dining. You had scandals in Florida. You've had scandals really all over the United States in which district attorney's offices or police forces have used these pots of money for whatever they like. And it's you know, arguably a direct result of being able to raise their own money aside from the oversight of government, of local government.
So do you think there's a possible link between the nature of the forfeiture system and the kind of corruption that D.A. Hines is now being investigated for, allegedly spending forfeiture money on his campaign?
Yeah, I do, because I think that most agencies are looking for cash, are always in need of cash, and forfeiture creates a rare scenario where law enforcement agencies in particular, district attorney's offices and police forces, are able to raise sometimes huge amounts of money really outside of any kind of oversight or even knowledge of government or the public. And that's a pretty powerful incentive. And it seems to me that it's not surprising that that money often gets spent on questionable things.
Listeners, any forfeiture stories to contribute to this conversation? Maybe you've had assets seized when you were once arrested. Maybe you're an attorney who's been involved with this in one way or another. A victim, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we look into the origins of the source of the money that Brooklyn DA, former Brooklyn DA Charles Hines, is now accused of spending improperly, this forfeiture money seized mostly from drug dealers in the Brooklyn DA's office. Carlos in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carlos.
Yes. Good morning, Brian. I have an interesting story. It's not exactly criminally related to me, but I own a business where someone attempted to just grab money from the register while and my security and the manager chased him, were able to get the money back. And when the police came and arrested this gentleman, they had to voucher this cash, and this is about 8 years ago, and we're still dealing with Robert Johnson, Bronx DA office, to try to get this measly $220. It's like it goes into a black hole.
So you were the crime victim. You were robbed.
Correct.
And did the DA's office say they were going to get you your money back as well as prosecute the criminal?
We've been there about three or four times, and I need to get a letter, and it has to be notarized, and my security has to go back, and my manager, and it becomes like an impossible task.
Meanwhile, it might be...
And the 47th precinct where this occurred has, like, no record of this crime. I have a video where showing this crime.
They have no record of the crime?
Yes.
Huh. Well, that raises another issue. But, Carlos, thank you very much. But it sounds possible, putting together his story and the Gothamist story, Isaiah, that money could have gone into the NYPD pension fund. And Carlos is struggling for years to get it back. Of course, if there's no record of the crime, he's got other issues.
Sure, right. Yeah, and I think it would be interesting for maybe an intrepid local reporter to start figuring out where the money's going, how much is being collected, and how it's being collected. You know, in Philadelphia, it took a while. I had to pull thousands of court records. But I was able to piece together sort of how that money was coming in, although not where it was going. In Philadelphia, it was what sounds like maybe a similar situation. It was all being deposited into an asset forfeiture fund. It sounds like New York has a similar structure in which the money sort of gets dumped into this pot. And then you have to ask who's in charge of that pot and where is the policy set as to how the money is distributed? Who has discretion over it?
John in Nolita, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Yeah, hi. I was just curious. The New York State government can basically swipe everything out of a checking account if there's a tax issue or anything like that, and it really hampers small business people that run into a little bit of trouble with
that. You mean they can put like a tax lien on your bank account if you owe back taxes? Is that
Absolutely.
What you're referring to?
And they will wipe out the account unannounced. And that really caused a problem for people that employ other people, because you can write a bunch of checks on a Friday and then Monday morning, everything's gone. And there's, you know, the business owner's stuck with, you know, paying all the bounce checks and there's no accountability. Now, my problem is, you know, the city gets ripped off for hundreds of millions of dollars from SAIC or HD, and there's nobody going after that money, which you would think $100 million would be more important than a $5,000 tax issue. But that's not the way it works.
Interesting, John. Thank you. So Isaiah Thompson from ProPublica, that's a very different kind of case. A drug dealer who then their relatives, like in the first story you told, have their property seized without any due process versus somebody who owes back taxes who then gets a lien placed on their bank accounts by the government. But they do overlap, and it's one of the reasons that I guess forfeiture rules are not just a progressive concern. that you quote a libertarian group in your article concerned about law enforcement being able to take people's money without due process. I'll bet the libertarians would be all over that last caller's story.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Probably the two groups that have been most active around forfeiture in the last civil forfeiture in the last couple of years are the ACLU, and then the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian civil liberties organization, which has been very active and very aggressive in fighting civil forfeiture because they see it as an infringement upon individuals' rights to property.
So, what happened to Sandra Leno eventually, the woman in the clip we played before?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a sad story. Her whole family was forced to leave their house while her husband was still facing charges, had not been convicted. They, as you heard in the clip, they wound up living in a tent in New Jersey for a little while. Eventually, they rented another apartment. They couldn't pay the mortgage at the same time they were paying rent. And before the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office went through with the forfeiture, the house was foreclosed upon and they lost it. Her husband was convicted, but again, the police officers involved are now sort of under suspicion, and we'll see what comes of that case. But it's been a pretty tough time for her family. I've kept in touch with her now and then.
So listeners, now you know, as you hear stories going forward about former Brooklyn DA Charles Hines and the money seized from drug dealers, as the media usually refers to it, that he's accused of misspending on his campaign, that pot of money itself is controversial. We thank Isaiah Thompson, reporter for the news organization ProPublica, who did an investigative report mostly on forfeiture in Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, with all equine facing eyes on Belmont Raceway this week with a possible triple crown for California Chrome, we will look at the race and the history of horse racing culture in New York City with somebody who's been covering it for 50 years. Stay with us.